People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Youth mental health is in serious decline, according to Mental Health Research Canada. They're a national charitable organization that emerged from the former Ontario Mental Health Foundation. They recently put out a report exploring youth mental health. It was commissioned by Bell Let's Talk and produced in partnership with several mental health organizations. On today's program, we're going to hear from one of the authors of that report to dig into why youth mental health is in decline and what we might be able to do about it. We're also going to hear from Isaiah Neal. He's an advocate for youth mental health who gives keynote speeches where he shares his experiences as a suicide attempt survivor. Neal was one of a panel of youth who spoke at a launch event in Toronto for the research into youth mental health. According to Mental Health Research Canada, suicide is the second leading cause of death for young people in Canada, and Canadian youth aged 16 to 24 are more likely to report suicidal ideation and planning than any other age group, with 24% experiencing suicidal thoughts and 8% planning a suicide attempt. As of November 2023, there is a national suicide crisis hotline in Canada. The number is 988. Before we get to my conversation with Isaiah Neal, I want to play you some of what he shared at the panel in Toronto in October.
As it was said, I am a suicide attempt survivor, and I honestly wear that with a lot of pride, not because it's some sort of accomplishment, but when you deal with suicide and you're in that space of mind, you enter this dark abyss, and in this dark abyss, your will to live and hope dies. To give you a little bit of context, I come from 14 years of playing the game of football, and you quickly learn that the status quo is shove your emotions down and don't talk about it. When you get hurt on the field, you pick up your teeth and you run. it's quite like that, and it's like that in many other sports. You keep running and running and running until you literally cannot stop or continue running. And so when I was dealing with suicide, that was the first thing that I had to learn, was to open up and talk about it. And so to kind of go back to this dark, deep abyss, imagine, you know, going to this busy, unknown city and you don't have a GPS. It's not going to turn out too well, right? You're not going to be able to get anywhere that you need to go. And this GPS is like this will to live, this hope, because your will to live and your hope is your compass. It's your GPS to this busy, unknown city called life. And when I lost that compass, when I lost that GPS, I was lost. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's hard to understand this. Even going to therapy for myself, it's like, what's the problem? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why I don't want to live. I don't know why I don't want to see tomorrow. And you get stuck. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's hard to understand that. And if you ever, you know, if you would like to kind of expand your knowledge on that, I really strongly encourage listening to people that are suicide attempt survivors. There's a great book called One Friday in April. It's Someone's Suicide Experience by David Atrum. And it's well orchestrated. But, you know, the thing about the 21% of youth dying by suicide, there's two ways you can look at it. You can look at it and say, wow, that's a lot of youth that we've lost and will lose at this rate. Or you can say, wow, that's a lot of youth that have lost hope, that have lost a will to live. And the other, you know, flip side of this is like, you know, that's numbers, right? But when you actually put yourself in the shoes of a person that is dealing with suicide ideation, it takes a lot of courage and strength that is beyond measure or imagination to actually die by suicide. It's crazy. And for me, this statistic is like, wow, there's 21% of youth that will go down this path and go through these hard decisions and make that decision to end their lives. And for me, that's the scary thing. And for me now, it's like the question for all of us in this room is, why are young people losing hope? right? We can look at it at a psychological level and a science level and look at the statistics, but at the end of the day, the question is, why are young people losing hope? And it's not a straightforward answer, right? But for all of us in this room, our responsibility is to be that light in that abyss and show them the way out.
Isaiah Neal, speaking as part of a panel on youth mental health in October at Toronto Metropolitan University. I had the chance to follow up with him ahead of this week's program. At a recent panel, you said the question is, why are young people losing hope? Could you tell me more maybe about that question and where it comes from?
Yeah, for sure. So suicide is a very hard topic to talk about. It's also very hard to understand whether you're the one that's experiencing it or you're around other people that are experiencing it. But at the end of the day, it's really that loss of hope. It's that loss of will to live. And that is really the problem that we're having. There's many ways to look at suicide, but I think the easiest way to look at it is that loss of hope. And how do we return that hope to that person? And how do we restore that? And not only just restore that, how do we maintain it? Because sometimes it goes out and sometimes it comes back on. It's kind of flickers. So how do we maintain that hope and that will to live?
Could you maybe tell me about your process of finding that hope again and maintaining that hope?
Yeah, for sure. So I struggled a lot with suicide for the last about 3 years, in and out of depression. And then it usually get followed by not wanting to live. And so what I found was talking about it was the biggest thing, because for me, when I was dealing with suicidal ideation, I got trapped in this echo chamber of negative thoughts and negative thinking. And it required a person outside of my bubble to come and kind of break that cycle. But most oftentimes, you have to ask for that help. You have to ask for that third person. And that can be very difficult for you to do when you're inside this bubble. So for me, I was kind of just that leap of faith and that hope that I got nothing else to lose. I might as well try something. And I took a really drastic measure and revealed what I was going through and asked for help from pretty much everyone that was around me, whether it was my family. I was currently playing for the University of Alberta on the football team. So I was talking with coaches, with teammates, just reaching out and just talking about what I was going through. And when I realized that, hey, I'm stuck in this echo chamber of negative thoughts, I was able to see, hey, you know, there's more than what I'm seeing here, right? There's more to the issue. And when I started to have those conversations more and more, just made things a little bit easier each day. Of course, I had ups and downs, but again, just went back to, you know, making sure that you're talking to someone is the biggest thing.
You talked in the past about 14 years of playing football, and there can be this culture within some sports of, you use the phrase, you know, you get hurt on the field, you pick up your teeth and run. So what was it like when you were maybe talking to coaches and people involved in the sport about what you were going through?
Yeah, so it was definitely very difficult. And I think the very first coach that I reached out to had also shared his struggles with suicide during COVID, because during COVID, there was no season. And we had these little workshop sessions where we kind of shared and talked about our experiences. And so when I was going through my period of suicidal ideation at the time, I remember that coach. And I was like, hey, that's a great starting point. And so I started talking to him. Then there was another staff member on our team that does a lot of kind of psychological and motivational training. And I was like, well, that's another great person. So I talked to her, and slowly I kind of just built the strength, because both of those people were so receptive. And they were also encouraging me, like, hey, don't be scared. This team is going to love you no matter what. And then that's when I built up the courage to kind of just let everyone know, like, hey, sometimes I'm going to be struggling. Sometimes I'm going to be down. But, you know, bear with me and hold me up, and I'm going to be here for you guys 100% of the way.
So there was someone who had maybe shared their own story, their own experiences, and that helped it make it a lot easier for you to like open up in the first place to someone?
Exactly. And that's really the reason why I open up now, is because there's always going to be that one person that's looking like, who else is dealing with this? And a lot of times, you know, when I've shared my story, I find other people that are also struggling, and we have a conversation, and that's kind of like their first step into the right direction. So it's the reason why I am so open, because it was really the answer for me. And I'm hoping that I can help someone else out as well.
You also recommended for people looking to maybe learn more about the topic, a book, One Friday in April. Can you tell me maybe a little bit about what you found that it did a good job at?
Yeah, for sure. So obviously, from a person that has experienced suicide and suicidal ideation, as well as attempting suicide, this book really encapsulated a very special kind of feeling or a moment in time when you're going through something like this that is not in textbooks. It cannot be described by most people. It's something that people have trouble explaining. And it's this weird, I guess, on the fence feeling of letting go, but still wanting to hold on. And I think that's a really important thing when it comes to people that are struggling with suicide. It's not always that they want to die. It's a last resort option that they see no way out. And I believe that this book does an excellent job of encapsulating this feeling that, you know, I don't want to die, but I don't see any way out. And this is what I got to do. There is no other answer. So that's really what hit home for me. And I hope it hits home for anyone else reading it, because it is very difficult to understand when someone's opening up to you and saying that they don't want to live anymore.
Are there any things that you feel like maybe our systems of care could do a better job at making it easier to see a different pathway out of those situations?
That's a good question. I honestly don't have a straightforward answer for that, but I think it comes from listening to people with lived experience, because it's one thing to read about it or to hear about it in a textbook or an academic setting, or even from a clinician. It's different for everyone. My experience is not going to be the same as someone else's. And so it's extremely important that we listen to everyone's story to kind of paint this bigger picture and see where this can actually lead. And unfortunately, that's kind of the hard part, is why we don't have this bigger picture, because we don't have enough people that are open to it. And that goes a lot with stigma in our society, why people don't talk about it, but also the different demographics that don't speak about it. There's lots of different cultures that this is a very taboo subject, but a lot of those demographics are what we are seeing in the reports for mental health increase and declines, that these individuals and these demographics are not speaking up about it, which is why we have no idea on how to help them, because we're not hearing their story.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the big new report, the national report on youth mental health. And of course, a few things you just said really relevant to this. The idea that mental health itself is such like an umbrella term and a continuum that every one person is going to have their own different experiences. But maybe some of the trends from there that stood out to me was there was this idea that young people are talking much more about mental health and mental health issues than other generations, but with two big caveats. That one, the report suggested there was still a lot of stigma for people to talk about their own experiences, what they were going through, and that two, even with young people talking more, the report suggested their mental health literacy was about the same as anyone else. And I'm wondering if you could speak to maybe some of those ideas.
Yeah, for sure. So I definitely think there's kind of two main categories in terms of why people don't speak. Obviously, there's not only two categories, but the two big ones that I see are those that personally just don't want to disclose that because they see it as some type of weakness as well. It's very private, so that's totally okay. But then there's also that group that doesn't want to speak out because they don't feel like there is a space. And that's the real big category that is a problem for me, because how many more people want to speak out or want to ask for help, but they can't because they don't have a safe place. And that's really a responsibility for all of us to take on. Is, you know, you may not understand the whole scope of mental health, but we can all show kindness and respect for other people's experiences and whatnot when it comes to mental health. So I think that's something that is kind of very easy to do theoretically, but of course, to change people's minds and perspectives is definitely very hard. When it comes to the report, when it's talking about the literacy, that is not as much of a big surprise to me. I think because we're so much on our phones, we're downloading and digesting what we see the most, which is what's on our phones. And I don't think the media has done a good job in terms of putting out safe language and literacy. I think that's still kind of kept behind the gates by academics and certain communities that have that access to that type of literacy. But I think that can be also improved as well with having these organizations that have the knowledge to be on these platforms and share knowledge, kind of like Jack.org does. Again, just sharing those little tidbits of knowledge and messages, as well as literacy that can go a long way when it comes to opening up and talking about mental health or suicide.
You use their two phrases, safe language and literacy. And I'm wondering if there you feel there are any maybe especially important or easy to get across points that you think more people should know about that you could share.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the biggest ones is the use of committed suicide. Rather, we should say died by suicide. Committed is an accomplishment. It's a tick off the to-do list. And suicide isn't like that. And it's not fair to do that to the victims. It's more respectful to say someone has died by suicide, to respect the facts that what they've gone through, as well as the means and the nature that they have passed. So I think that's one of the biggest ones. I think in terms, maybe not so much literacy, but in terms of how we talk about mental health, not seeing mental health or mental illness as the person, but seeing it as something that they are facing or they are living with. For me, I dealt a lot with anxiety. I've had anxiety attacks over dozens of times, and I've fainted. I've had convulsions. I've gone numb in my toes and my hands. And for a long time, I really identified with anxiety. I believed that I had this problem. But when I changed the perspective that I was living with anxiety, maybe similar to when we say, hey, someone is living with cancer, it really separates the two, that we have this individual, we have this person, and we see them as the person that they are. But then there's something that they're facing, and that is the anxiety. But in no way, shape, or form is the anxiety who they are or their identity. So really separating those two allows the person to show up in a good way and to show up how they are as a person apart from that and not be labeled by that.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is Isaiah Neal. He's a mental health advocate and keynote speaker in Edmonton. He's involved with the charity Jack.org, which trains young people to build their leadership and advocacy skills in order to contribute to societal change and address mental health issues, particularly youth suicide. Earlier this month, Neal was part of a panel of speakers on youth mental health at Toronto Metropolitan University to mark the release of a new national report on the subject of youth mental health from Mental Health Research Canada. You also mentioned earlier that sort of everyone is on their phones. And in this panel discussion earlier this month, yes, it's still October, as we're speaking, you shared that when you were in high school, you weren't really a social media user. Can you tell me about that experience of being born in the 21st century and not using social media?
Yeah, for sure. So I remember my very first phone was an LG Android, and it was one of those ones that you like slide and you have like a keyboard underneath the screen. And that was like my first interaction with the phone, I think at about the age of 12. And then I like found out that I wasn't cool and I had an Android and it slid, and I was like, no, I need an iPhone. So I got an iPhone. And, you know, just having a phone for me, it was kind of almost pointless. Like I never answered calls. I never answered text messages because I was just never on my phone, even for social media. Social media was kind of something that my parents, specifically my mom, kind of just shied me away from and said, don't get involved. And at the time, you know, I was the only child and I was very obedient and I didn't want to make her upset. So I just didn't go on it. And then, you know, going through all of junior high, I never had social media. So by the time I got to high school, it's like, why am I jumping on something just for the sake of it? I've always been a hard person on myself for not just joining something for the sake of it, just because everyone else is doing it. It was a personal decision. And when I look back at it, I really see all the benefits. So, you know, at the time I wasn't like not on social media because I was like, oh, I don't want to, you know, mess up my head. No, I just personally made that decision. And in retrospect, in hindsight, I'm like, wow, that made a really big difference in my life. And, you know, I'm on social media now for sure. But just my relationship with it now and seeing how, you know, my peers were at my age when I didn't have social media and how it's changed them and affected them, you know, that's something that I see now. And I'm really thankful that I was able to kind of escape that in some way. So yeah, it's definitely been good not to have so much social media in my life at such an early age.
What do you think are some of the big impacts that maybe you see in your peers?
biggest one is anxiety, 100% anxiety. As a young person, you are really kind of starting life, you know, at the age of junior high and going into high school, you're trying to figure out who you are. You're trying to figure out, you know, what will happen? What will I turn into? And when you're seeing all these other great people, or you're seeing all these great facades of people and the great sides of people, you start to look at yourself and you'll be like, you know, I'm not that great, or, oh, that person's better than me, or, oh, that person's doing better than me. And you end up with this negative self-stigma that, oh, I'm just me, you know, and you get anxious about your future. You get anxious about what other people think about you. And so that is the biggest thing that I find with young people, even speaking to young people in large audiences that I've done for keynote presentations, anxiety is a huge thing that pops up. Like, people are just anxious about pretty much everything and anything, whether it be meeting people, being in big crowds, needles. Like, there's just so many anxieties out there. So that's a big one.
Could you tell me maybe a bit about your journey to sharing your story with people? How did this become something that you are speaking with big crowds about?
Yeah, for sure. So my story kind of started off in my first year of university. I went to the U of A, got accepted into a specialization for biochemistry, really big and smart. And so I also got an offer to play for the Golden Bears football team. And, you know, in the moment, I was like, yeah, this sounds great. Like, this sounds fun. Like, this is going to be awesome. And then October of my first semester hit and I got a concussion. And then after that, I kind of fell into this depression. I was isolated because I couldn't be with the team because of my concussion. I couldn't do schoolwork, so my grades fell. And I slowly just ended up in this snowball effect of like going downhill. And the more and more I became depressed, the more and more I considered my life. What's the point of living? Is this all that life has to offer? Is this really going to be the next 4 or 5 years of my life as I finish my degree? And so when I first started struggling, I didn't know anything about mental health and I didn't know what to do. And so I reached out to someone on the athletics board and said, hey, I don't know what I need. This is how I'm feeling. I just had a concussion. I don't know if it's related to this or what, but I need help or else it's not going to end well. And then I got referred to a therapist and went to a therapist, had no idea what a therapist was. All I knew was like, hey, maybe I'll be sitting in a big comfy couch and I'll be reading my problems and they'll be asking me what I see in the ink blots. Like, I had no idea what it was. And then I went and we just had a conversation. And we talked about some of the things that I was going through and reframed my mind. And then when I got that, I was like, wow, like, it's just a change of mindset and things started to kind of change. Then the next year was COVID. And that was, for me, it was kind of good because I had a lot of anxiety. And when I didn't have to go out and I didn't have to be at practice, I was like, cool, I just get to be in my house. Awesome. And then after that, when COVID ended, I had to face my anxiety. And so I experienced severe panic attacks. I was never diagnosed, but pretty convinced I was probably dealing with general anxiety disorder. And I was like fainting like every other day, fainting from my anxiety, going numb. I've fainted in my car. I fainted in class. I fainted at my house. I've fainted in the bathroom, like everywhere I have fainted. And that was like a real big turn for me because I was like, I thought things were getting better. And so when I started struggling again, I was like, you know what? I'm going to take an aggressive action to this and fight it. Just kind of like how cancer survivors kind of take on that survivor and that fighter kind of persona and they fight back. So my response to fighting back was to bring awareness, to say, hey, this is okay to struggle. This is who I am. This is part of who I am. And it just kind of got addicting. And then I got an opportunity to speak at school about athletics and mental health. And they're like, hey, can you do like 4 sessions for 4 classes and talk about mental health and athletics? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And I sent off the email like, yeah, I'll be there. And I'm like, I've never spoken to kids before. I've never shared my story in my life. So I was like, okay, let's do this. So like made up my own material and, you know, shaped it around my story and my experiences as an athlete. And, you know, I went through the 4 sessions all on the same day back to back. And I was just so hooked on it. It was amazing. Like, people loved it. The kids resonated with it. The teachers were like amazed by it. And I was like, you know what, maybe I should start doing this. And so I ran into jack.org, and that's when kind of my passion for speaking about mental health really took off. And, you know, started doing it more and more. And I was like, hey, you know what? I think I can do this. Like, I'm pretty good at this. And yeah, ever since I just haven't stopped. And recently I've kind of launched my own keynote presentation called Behind the Mask. And it's my 5-year reflection battling anxiety, depression, and suicide as a collegiate athlete at the U of A. So yeah, it's where it's at right now.
So when you give that talk, when it goes well, you get that good feeling after, what do you see are the impacts?
The biggest impacts is I see people open up. And you know, after I'm done talking, I might get a few questions of like, hey, like, how did you get through this hard time? Or like, what was the deciding factor? What was the one thing that helped you? And for me, that's the biggest thing. Cause I'm like, hey, I just broke the stigma. Like, people are talking about it. Right. And, you know, they may not be talking about it with everyone. Right. But at least I am one start to that. And maybe, you know, it builds their confidence to be like, hey, maybe I can talk to someone. Maybe this is okay. The other thing really is breaking down that I guess knowledge about mental health and how to approach it, because lots of people just don't know how to approach it. And so that's really the satisfaction that I get out of it, is, you know, using my tragedy to help someone else is always a very powerful tool, because there's nothing like lived experience.
If someone's listening to us talking and they say like, wow, this is going to stick with me, what would you hope someone carries with them? What would you hope maybe is like an action they can take, or a thing they can try and keep in mind weeks, months down the road?
Yeah, for sure. Two things. So I would say, you know, it's okay to struggle with whatever you're, you know, battling with right now. Life has many challenges and we all face our own challenges, and it's okay to struggle. The second thing I would say is, you are worth more than what you are at any given moment. And that's a saying that I go by every single day, because truthfully and honestly, there's going to be many negative moments in our life. There's going to be times that we fail. There's going to be times that we mess up. There's going to be times where we have to say goodbye to people, or we have to break relationships. But at the end of the day, none of those moments make or break us. Moments are temporary. They come and go. They can't change our worth or stop our growth, because we are worth more than what we are at any given moment.
Isaiah Neal, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
For sure. My pleasure.
Isaiah Neal is a mental health advocate and keynote speaker in Edmonton.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
A report from Mental Health Research Canada says the mental health of Canadian youth is in serious decline. What exactly does that mean? I spoke with the organization's vice president, Michael Cooper, who said that to show things have gotten worse, we need to look into the past.
What we wanted to accomplish with that report was not just look at where youth are today, because, you know, generally it's accepted that youth are worse, but in order to say someone is worse, we needed to validate where they were in the past. So we wanted to pull up historical records that we were able to find. And I think we looked as far back as 1977, which is before I was born, trying to understand what sort of indicators we could track over time. And of course, how we talk about mental health has shifted quite a bit. And what we were able to identify was, you know, minor shifts in youth mental health shifting as early as 2003, and then shifting quite substantially for youth in around the 20 teens. So 2015, 2014, 2016, there was a more significant downward trend of youth mental health, and really trying to demonstrate that it was actually moving faster. Mental health, the decline was moving faster. And while all mental health indicators for most Canadians have gone down slightly, youth is a far more dramatic decline in mental health indicators over the last 10 years.
I asked Cooper, what exactly are we talking about when we say mental health?
Mental health is a spectrum. As you no doubt know, there's everything from mental wellness to mental illness. There's abnormal and there's normal mental health. So I might feel depressed one day. That doesn't mean I have some sort of a depressive disorder. I might feel anxious one day. That doesn't mean I have an anxiety disorder. It's the perpetuation of these symptoms over time, and especially in abnormal circumstances, that actually can lead to some sort of a mental illness or actually be diagnosed as a mental illness. So what we're tracking is everything along that spectrum. So we can look at youth who have symptoms of mental distress. We can look at youth who have a diagnosis. We can look at youth who are just feeling down at that moment. And we can look at it from a variety of screeners, including the PHQ-9, the GAD-7 self-rated scales, longitudinal pieces, the Kessler Psychological Distress Scale, diagnosis, all of these things we look at. And you sort of build this map of, okay, this percentage of youth are fully diagnosed and accurately diagnosed. This percentage of youth are struggling today, but probably not a diagnosable condition. This is the percentage of youth that might be at risk of a diagnosis if they have the right environmental factors. And this is the highly resilient group of youth who are never going to be challenged because they have the tools, the mental faculties, and the sort of predisposition that they're not going to really, unless there was some extreme trauma or event that would drive them in that way, be likely to suffer a mental illness.
The report called the existing system for accessing mental health support in Canada disjointed. It says that approximately 70% of mental health services are delivered outside of provincial health systems, even though the bulk of mental health funding is directed toward these systems.
It's about 16% of the population who has access to mental health service in the past year. So among those, about 30% are accessing a provincially funded healthcare system. And among those people accessing a provincially funded healthcare system, about 70% are going to their GP. So the most common means of getting supported is through your GP if you're doing that type of service. The rest of it, we look at combinations of group insurance, and approximately 55 to 60% of Canadians believe they're covered by group insurance. It's actually a few percentage high who are actually covered. There's a gap between people who are aware they're covered or not in families, but it's about, you know, 60% approximately of people covered by group insurance. And we can look at that and we can understand what's going on there with caps on service, et cetera, et cetera. Then the next sort of common piece that we see is community-based supports. And from community-based supports, you can look at anything from something delivered on a campus. You can look at things delivered by churches, by school boards. You can look at a lot of those community-based supports. There's a lot of different ones. And then we look at free resources as well. And then we also look at out-of-pocket expenses. So in terms of the most prominence, it tends to go provincial healthcare systems, out-of-pocket group insurance, which we mix together into private-type services, community-based services, and then free-based resources, like if I download a self-help book or a self-help app or something along that lines as well, too. So that's sort of the delineation of how we break it down.
Cooper spoke about issues that can crop up with the way many people end up accessing mental health care as it stands right now.
What you actually see is a lot of people who access provincially funded services, they go on to access some sort of private service so they have access to it. But generally, that's not a sustainable solution from a talk therapy standpoint. Because if I have the average, according to Benefits Canada, is $750 in talk therapy services per individual who has a private benefits plan. And that's like three sessions. If I'm struggling with a significant mental health issue, three sessions is not going to be anywhere near enough to actually manage that. So what you typically see when you look at pathways to care is I went to my doctor asked if I had benefits, I got some sort of a private mental health support system, talk therapy, I accessed it until I depleted all of those funds, I accessed some degree of out-of-pocket piece. You see a lot of that overlap with I'm both doing private benefits and then I'm actually paying out of pocket because I need to go more than my benefits cover. And then what you see is a lot of those benefits covering medications as well. So, you know, medication alone is not considered the most effective treatment for many mental health conditions, but that is pragmatically what a lot of people with group benefits are using as a primary method of treating mental health. Eventually, a lot of those people with private benefits then transition into some sort of a community-based care because it's more sustainable. And that's what you see when you look at pathways to care. This is a very common thing when you start looking at individuals over a period of time.
So what changes could be made to the system? Cooper says changes to benefits and making employee assistance programs, or EAPs, more effective could help.
The first thing I would do is we need to, I would make private benefits more effective. And how I would do that would be increasing the amount of money that typically flows out from mental health benefits. I would make EAPs more effective so that if they're trying to move people off those benefits into using EAPs, that would make those more effective. And by more effective, the simplest thing that could be done is if I call an EAP, I may get a different counselor every time. And that sort of discontinuity of treatment is one of the main reasons people have pushed back against EAPs. I would increase the amount of benefits to at least $2,000, but this creates another problem. We don't suddenly have more supply of mental health professionals if you go from $750 to $2,000 in group benefits for 60% of the population. What you're basically doing is you're just creating a bottleneck at the supply side, because there aren't enough benefit providers to actually address if there was that much money in the system. So one of the other things we've been talking about is, how do we regulate these industries that are eligible for group benefits? So it's actually a little bit of, people don't realize, but depending on what province you're in, you might be able to spend your mental health benefits differently depending on what province you're in, based on different sorts of suppliers, like psychotherapists versus psychiatrists versus sort of different professions within the industry.
This is People First Radio. We're focusing on youth mental health right now. A report from Mental Health Research Canada on the subject found that youth mental health is in serious decline. We've been hearing from Mental Health Research Canada's Vice President Michael Cooper. One finding from the report was that youth are having more conversations around mental health, but that their literacy around it wasn't any greater than in the general population.
So that was a really fascinating finding, where we assumed that there would be a correlation between the consumption of mental health content and people's literacy pertaining to concepts in mental health, terminology in mental health. Like, we started this call by talking about the difference between mental wellness, mental illness, and mental health. What do those three terms mean? And for a lot of people, they're just interchangeable words, but they're not. So from a terminology standpoint, we didn't find that youth were any more or less aware of what these terms actually meant. They didn't know the difference between abnormal and normal mental health. They were generalizing, like, mental health is something we should be talking about, but then they weren't able to differentiate what mental health specifically was compared to, like, mental health versus mental illness versus mental wellness. They couldn't differentiate. They couldn't differentiate between understanding around correlations between substance use and mental health, and how those sort of Venn diagram sort of can connect together in a lot of ways as well. And it was fascinating, because we fully expect that. We ran one study where we looked at the consumption of mental health media. So I'm reading about mental health, I'm talking about mental health, I'm comfortable talking about mental health. And then we ran a second study which looked at your actual ability to correctly answer terms and concepts. And that's where we saw that discrepancy in youth, where they were consuming a lot more, but they weren't actually far more knowledgeable. It was a mile of interest and inch of depth of that knowledge. But there's one more thing I wanted to highlight around that as well, too. We also had that opportunity to look around stigma. And what we found was, youth consuming that much media were about mental health were far more likely to feel comfortable talking about mental health. But that change was primarily driven by, I'm comfortable about talking about to other people about mental health. So I'm comfortable if you want to talk to me about your mental health, but I'm not nearly as comfortable talking about my mental health to you. So we talked about this variation between self-stigma, my ability to talk about mental health, my own mental health, versus me listening to you and providing advice. And there was a variation. It was like a 20% gap in comfort levels, which I thought was fascinating as well. So we're making progress in content. We're making progress in media consumption, but we need to go that extra mile in actually getting people the literacy so that they can be better advocates, better navigation, and also more comfortable talking about themselves. So there's room to grow there.
Cooper says people in charge of health systems could better direct resources towards community care that can be more consistent for people.
I do think that there's a role and responsibility for people in charge of health systems. I think we spend a lot of money on provincial healthcare systems, which could be better spent in getting people community-based care that could actually perpetuate, which is with specialists versus a GP who all mean well, but may not have the tools in front of them to actually support someone on an ongoing basis.
Cooper says that we'll never solve this problem in this generation, but we can work to improve things.
We're on this pathway of improving data and evidence-based solutions. And this has really been something out of the pandemic. We threw a lot of spaghetti against the wall. We needed a lot of services for people, especially virtual-based services, because people couldn't access that. There were a lot of people who were in those risk factors who suddenly found themselves with actually diagnosable conditions because of the environmental factors sending them over the edge. So I think what we saw out of that was we're never going to have enough mental health practitioners to solve this problem this generation. There's just too many Canadians who need mental health supports. So we need to maximize the resources we have, which means we're looking for better evidence, but we're also looking for navigation so that people can find available services. And we're looking for scalability, which is where we start having conversations about digital tools, hybrid ICBT programs, internet cognitive behavioral therapy sort of programs, and making these services to be more evidence-based. There was a study that was done which showed there were like 20 or 30,000 apps and only like 4% of them were actually using any evidence. So really what there needs to be is a lot more frameworks around evidence-based pieces. There needs to be a movement of dollars from provincial healthcare systems into community-based care. And I was really happy to see the federal government invest $500 million into community-based care in the last budget as well. But that's a drop in the bucket compared to what's actually needed. And the economic impact of that will be felt over generations. And governments tend to think in, 4-year cycles or 3-year cycles or 5-year cycles. And when you start saying, well, you're going to make this investment in youth now, and we're going to see, a 3% increase in youth mental health indicators, which will output economic indicators for the rest of their lives, that's too long of a time frame. So, we're sort of struggling with this space of how do we actually make the impacts more immediate so that we can drive more money into community-based care.
Michael Cooper is Vice President of Mental Health Research Canada.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM from Nanaimo, British Columbia, and on CFMH, Local 107.3 FM from St. John, New Brunswick.
Next, a story from Jay Sadler of CFMH in St. John via the Local Journalism Initiative.
While mental health struggles may not affect everyone throughout their lifetime, grief and loss almost certainly will. Whether it's the loss of a loved one, a job, a friend, a home, or even a pet, grief can profoundly impact a person's life. The Compassionate Grief Center, a nonprofit charity in St. John, offers a unique approach to support those dealing with grief through its inclusive Grief Cafe, a comfortable, relaxed, community-building experience. I sat down with founder Jamie and counselor Kat to learn more, beginning with how the stigma around grief and mental health challenges has evolved.
I noticed specifically, being as young as I am, being 28 years old, I noticed that the world, I grew up in, we started having conversations more. Awareness, education is the standard, is the norm. So when I'm working with clients from Gen X or baby boomers, or sometimes even clients in their 80s and 90s, the silent generation, it's fascinating to see just how far we've come. So when we use terms like coping skills, they're like, what is that? What is that even? We didn't have those conversations when I was a kid, and hearing their stories about how relatives were put away in asylums or sanitariums because they're experiencing symptoms, depressive symptoms, anxious symptoms, things we have labels for and names for and validation for nowadays. It's astonishing to see how far we've come. And, I still think we have a ways to go too, because even though now it's kind of part of our verbiage that it's okay not to be okay, I think we're headed in towards a direction where we take that a step further. It's okay not to be okay. Let's change that. Let's get you okay.
Jamie shared her personal experiences with grief and what inspired her to open the center.
I think it's really good for everybody to understand why we're here and what got us here. And that has to stem from, I guess, my history. So Jamie Godfrey, and I'm the CEO and founder of the Compassionate Grief Center. So if we go back to my past, my husband and I were trying very, very hard to have a child. And it wasn't happening. But then we got pregnant. And we were so very excited to the point where it was just like we wanted to shout it out to the world. And we tried, because we got 3 months into the pregnancy, and we were just thought that was a safe space and we could actually go in and tell the world that we're pregnant. Unfortunately, as time went on, I ended up getting a lot of tests because I was in over the age of 30 having children, and they found out that the baby was had a really strong heartbeat, but it wasn't growing. And all they kept telling me is to hold on to hope. Please hold on to hope. So I kept holding on, but the prognosis wasn't going to be great. A little later, we found out that the baby wasn't going to make it. I miscarried, and I thought at around the four months gestation part. So the point when you're supposed to be excited mm-hmm. and everything was going to go really well, or we were hoping it was going to go well. And I've never felt the pain that I felt when I lost that baby. It was agonizing. It was lonely. I was sad. I didn't know what to do. All I could think about was that I really wanted to fix it. Like, I wanted the pain to go away. I never wanted to feel this again. So the easiest way for me to get that pain to go away was to try again. So I went to my husband and I'm like, "Husband, let's do this again. I want to try to have another baby." He was like, "No, you're crying on the floor all the time, Jamie. You're away from your friends. You don't want to talk to anybody. You don't know how to address what you're feeling, and you need time. I don't want to do this to you. You're not mentally well." And I'm like, "Well, basically, okay. How do I get help? I don't mm-hmm. want to talk to my friends. I don't want to talk to my family. I don't want to burden them." Mm-hmm. What do I do? I felt like I should be going into a mental health institution or mental health and addictions, or I just had no idea at that time. So that would have been that's over 10 years ago. And I didn't know where I fit, but I needed to do something. Luckily, I had a good AEAP. Luckily, I found a good therapist. Luckily, she helped me drastically. Mm-hmm. But I knew at that particular time that I never wanted anybody to go through this type of pain again.
But what exactly is grief? And when should someone seek help?
Grief is that intense emotional phenomenon that we experience to any perceived loss. So whether it was expected, unexpected, intended, unintended, it is loss. So a relationship ending, someone moving, losing a job, that is grief. The tricky part about grief is, you know, as Jane has mentioned before, this idea of we want to fix it. We're in sort of the business of acknowledging that you're not broken, you're grieving. Every person on this planet will experience loss at some point in their lifetime, whether it's a death, whether it's a divorce, what have you. We will experience loss. It is human to experience loss. The question is why are we not talking about it? Why are we not talking to each other about it? Why are we not seeking help, seeking tools? Why are we not normalizing this? Why is grief something to get over or move on from? So to answer your question, you know, when should someone pursue grief counseling as a niche? I think if anybody can recognize within themselves, whether it's 30 years after a loved one has died or 1 month after a divorce or a breakup of a relationship, once you have identified within yourself that I have lost, whether it's a person, place, thing, when you have identified I have lost and I want or I need to talk about it, we're here for that. It's never too early. It's never too late.
One of the most unique aspects of the center's work is the Grief Cafe. Kat explains how it has helped others and shares an inspiring story about the success of one of its members.
So when I first started here at the Compassionate Grief Center in 2022, we were piloting a project known as the Grief Cafe, and I was kind of spearheading that project. And, you know, going into it, it's like, okay, we know the demand is out there. How are we going to get this program to take off? You know, how are we going to make this a safe space for people dealing with grief and loss, living in a society where you're told to just move on, grieve quietly, don't burden your family and friends? How are we going to make this work? So through the weeks starting up the cafe, it was rocky trying to get our name out there, trying to get people in and comfortable to discuss something that is so painful and uncomfortable that we avoid talking about naturally. It was rocky. But the people who were coming in wanted to be there. They never experienced anything like this, nor had I, as a relatively fresh counselor, creating an environment in a space where we're talking about probably one of the most, you know, raw, intimate experiences that a person will experience in their life, which is grief and loss. And so being present for that, we, you know, the small group, the core, as we call it, grew exponentially over time. And there's one individual in particular who heard our ad on the radio for Grief Cafe and he had lost his spouse. And he, you know, he heard us on the radio and he just took a whim, like, why not? I can't feel any worse than I do now. Let's see what it's about. And he started to attend Grief Cafe religiously. Religiously. It almost became a running joke that, you know, if I'm not here, be worried. And that's what he would tell us every week. If I'm not here, be worried. He kind of became, he became part of us very quickly. His story resonated with so many community members, and he had a finesse for words, and he had a way of speaking to someone with so much, I think, attentiveness. He made you feel heard, and he continues to do so. So after, oh my goodness, how long has Cafe been running? 2 years in August? 2 years. He still attends every week. But since that time, he has grown so much in his grief journey. He became the spokes family for one of our fundraising events. We have an annual tug of war event, and we have a family who is highlighted, and they share their grief story and their impact, or our impact on their grief journey. And he volunteered for that. He's a very kind of quiet, demure kind of guy, so he stepped up to the plate and spoke in front of everybody, and it was so touching and it was so moving, and he almost became like our biggest cheerleader. And after that, it just kept moving. He eventually wanted to do more and more. He believed in us and our purpose so much. He wanted to do more and more. And with our Grief Cafe, you know, as a clinician, I eventually moved out of it, and we had a community hostess who would host the cafe. And this individual over time kept asking, you know, what more can I do? What more can I do? And on days she would call in sick, and, you know, the cafe, we were thinking, oh, it could be canceled. Our hero, our knight in shining armor, stepped up to the plate, and he's like, you know what? I'm going to give this a try. And now he hosts, I'd say, pretty regularly.
Yeah. Whenever she's not there, yeah. He steps in.
He volunteers his time, and he shows up every week. Mm-hmm. And he tells us regularly, you're not going to get rid of me. he's a fixture here at the Compassionate Grief Center, and his heart is here.
And it's huge.
He calls it his second home.
Maybe it sounds self-explanatory, Grief Cafe. But I'd love to know more about that, because it sounds like such a unique program. And to be honest, it's what caught my attention originally when I was looking.
It's our most marketed.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe you can just speak to what makes it unique and what is a Grief Cafe.
So our Grief Cafe is basically a place where people who are grieving, doesn't matter who you lost, you come in at any point in time. You do not have to be committed. So for instance, unlike a group where you're expected to be here every single time, this cafe is, it's a set time. You just walk in, and during this time, and anytime you feel like the need to be there, you can be there.
The informality of it, I think, is the beauty of it.
Yeah.
You can come in, you don't know, every week is different. So we put a topic on the board for discussion, and that is totally optional. So if the group just naturally and organically flows into discussion, that's wonderful. But if there's ever a lull, there's always a topic that we can talk about. And it's usually, it is always rooted in grief. So asking people, it could be, you know, with Thanksgiving coming up, where's your grief at? You know, how is your grief impacted with the upcoming holiday season? That could be a weekly topic. Every week is different. And, you know, it's, again, you don't have to register. We have people who come once a month. We have people who come every single week, and they come early. They come 45 minutes and just get the coffee going, and they're just watching the parking lot. Who's coming this week? You know, it's different every week. And I think that's what keeps it exciting.
And I think that because there's no commitment, I think that's what everybody really loves about it. It's growing so much that we've had to have, it was just in the daytime. Then in the summer, we flipped it to the evening, and now we have to do both.
In addition to the Grief Cafe, the Compassionate Grief Center is deeply involved in reaching out to the community, offering educational services on grief and its impact.
So our team of professionals, our professional counselors, and Cappy and one of them, we have our biggest one currently is we offer a grief 101 service. So that's like for professionals like yourself or anybody in the community that's dealing with the public that wants to learn more about grief and how they could talk to somebody who is grieving and or identifying what types of grief there are and how people, how different people portray or what they look like when they're grieving. For instance, like Kat said, not everybody was like myself crying on the floor. Some people are you know, shelter themselves. Some people just look stone. Like there's a whole different, people express grief in different ways. So what this program led by a professional counselor does is helps us identify, helps the community and people working with the community, identifies what, you know, how to react when it comes to when someone's grieving, what to do, what the things to identify. So that's been one of our very much of an outreach program. Now we will also take that program. We do it here specifically, but sometimes we'll take that program elsewhere. So that like for different companies that may want that for their employees, we'll go there. We also do a lot of tailoring to the community. So for instance, if other organizations do need us to go, you know, into their business because they've identified that they've had an employee that had a loss and that they're struggling, their employees are struggling with that, we'll go in and we'll just, you know, have a little bit of a group chat.
And then twice a year, I know for me, a personal project, I go back to my high school that I graduated from, St. Matt's. I go usually once a semester. Yeah. And I talk to high school students about, you know, what I do as a mental health practitioner day in and day out, what that looks like. So it's always fascinating to share with, you know, our future, the young minds of today, what it is that we do here at the Grief Center, what it is that I do to support community members and, you know, the pathways that they could potentially take in pursuing a career in mental health services.
The Grief Cafe runs every Wednesday night from 6 to 8 p.m. and it is open to absolutely everyone. If you'd like to learn more, you can check out CompassionateGriefCenter.ca. This is Jay Sadler reporting for Local 107.3 FM in St. John as part of the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you very much to Jay Sadler, CFMH, and the Local Journalism Initiative for that story. That's all the time we have for the show. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.